Good morning. You're listening to KUNV 91.5, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, J. Patrick Kulikin. You can read my columns in the Las Vegas Sun and Las Vegas Weekly. My co-host, as always, Las Vegas Sun reporter Tobin LePan. Today we're talking payday loans and other high-interest alternative financial products. I have a lengthy piece on the subject that you can find this week at lasvegassun.com. A recent survey from the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation found that more than 6% of Nevadans are unbanked, meaning they have no bank account whatsoever, while one-third of us are what's called underbanked, meaning we have a bank account but use these high-interest financial products, including payday loans or title loans or pawn shops. Nevada leads the nation in the percentage of underbanked. Today, we'll talk about that phenomenon, as well as federal legislation that could loosen regulations on payday lenders and other high-interest lenders. Our guest is Dan Wolls. He's the Deputy Executive Director of Legal Aid of Southern Nevada, which assists the indigent in civil matters such as predatory lending. Wolls has been with Legal Aid since 1994. He's a graduate of the University of Kansas and Washburn University School of Law. Dan, thanks for being here.
Sure, my pleasure.
Let's start with the FDIC survey that says one-third of people in Southern Nevada are using these high-interest loans. I guess I'm not surprised that we lead the nation in the category, but the number is still a little shocking. One-third of people in Las Vegas Valley, with even higher numbers for certain ethnic minorities. What do you attribute that to?
It's hard to say. I would say that many people don't see the advantage in having a bank at all. And with the increasing with the increases we see in bank fees for checking accounts and such, they just don't think it's worth their while to have a checking account. Also, I think I've seen numbers that 20, 25, 30% of the population at large in the United States just aren't financially sophisticated at all, and you know, can't.
So, despite a really high interest rate, they see a more short-term calculation. I need this money now. Even if I have to pay a high interest rate, I'll take it.
Correct. And another part of it could be the economy as a whole, especially right now. Although payday loans seem to take off here and get their start in about the mid-1990s, as I observed. Even then, when the economy was well, payday loans got off the ground. So. Uh-huh. But certainly with the
economy, fact, they sprouted up like weeds when the economy was doing well.
That appears to be the case, at least in the 90s and throughout the 2000s.
Right.
But certainly when the economy is bad, I'm sure that people turn to short-term lenders more than they would otherwise.
Uh-huh. They're going to have trouble going and getting a bank loan, or maybe they've maxed out a credit card, or they're going to have trouble getting a credit card more than they would have during the good times.
Correct. And mainstream banks just aren't interested in loaning $300, $400, $500 or even $1,000. So they turn to the...
To a risky borrower.
They turn to the short-term lenders who are also the high-interest lenders.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've had a number of clients who've run into problems with payday lenders, and consumer advocates talk about a treadmill of debt, a debt trap. What is that? Describe that for us and talk about some of the dangers for consumers here.
Well, the debt treadmill is probably the principal danger in short-term high-interest lending. For whatever reason, when people borrow $200, $300, $400, $500, $600, they don't foresee having to come up with that sum plus the high interest in 2 or 3 or 4 weeks or whatever the term of the loan is. As a result, they typically just pay the interest that's due in whatever that short term is, 2 weeks or so, and that's called a rollover. And so then another 2 weeks goes by, and they don't have the principal and the interest, so they just pay the interest. And that's called the debt treadmill, of when you're just paying interest every 2 weeks or whatever the term of the loan is, just to keep kicking that can down the road.
Mm-hmm. The industry spokespeople, they say that this is a myth, and that people, maybe they take out a lot of loans because they have a lot of need for short-term loans. They're frequently in kind of an economic crisis. What is your judgment as to what percentage of people who are using these services get caught in that treadmill? Is there any?
I think I've seen studies that show that some 90% of people who take out short-term high-interest loans wind up doing a rollover and getting on the debt treadmill. And I think, and there's been studies that show that that's how the industry makes the bulk of its money. The industry does not make much money if you pay off the loan in 2 weeks. They only get one term of an interest payment there. So unfortunately, I think a high percentage of people do wind up rolling it over and wind up on the debt treadmill.
Mm-hmm. Now, one characteristic of predatory lending is often lending to somebody whose ability to repay is questionable. That seems on its face a little counterintuitive. Why would you lend to somebody who can't repay? I mean, doesn't that mean you're not going to get your money back, let alone any profit? So explain that to us, why that is a frequent feature of predatory lending, lending to people who can't repay.
I think they lend to working people, and they lend primarily to the working poor. They allow you to borrow an amount of money that you might not have in 2 weeks, but they think, and they correctly judge, that you will have at least the interest payment in 2 weeks.
Over time,
they will make way more than twice the amount they lent you, and I think that's what they're looking at. They're not going to lend to someone who can't repay them anything.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to lend to people who are the working poor, who have a paycheck, that they think will reliably come in and do the right thing, make mm-hmm. their payments, and try to repay the debt.
Uh-huh. And just you, as you said, these are people with jobs. I mean, you have to have a checking account to get a payday loan. And what they're doing is you postdate a check so that essentially the payday lender is sort of first in line to get paid back. I mean, that's kind of how it's working, right?
There are different kinds of loans, but yes, the traditional payday loan is where you give them a check that's postdated. So everyone knows you don't have that money in your account that day, otherwise mm-hmm. you wouldn't be borrowing money.
Right. So you literally cannot repay the loan at that moment.
Correct. Everybody knows that on the day you get the loan.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've given a postdated check, then yes, the payday lender, if you don't come in and pay, can deposit that check and see if it goes through.
Mm-hmm. Now, some payday lenders have been been accused of abuses, and you filed a class action lawsuit, one in particular against Handy Cash. Tell us about that.
That was filed after the payday loan laws that we have now were passed in 2005, and are revised in 2007. We found that Handy Cash was just on the face of their own loan contract, was violating the payday loan law, which is the Nevada Revised Statutes 604A. They were violating it in a number of ways, in terms of being able to charge late fees, which they can't charge in a payday loan, and charging amounts which they were not allowed to collect after default. So we filed a class action, and we obtained class certification. We got a preliminary injunction right off the bat from a Clark County District Court judge who found they were violating the law and told them to stop.
Tell us what it was like here before that law passed. Was it just kind of like the Wild West as far as what they could do?
Yes, it was virtually anything goes before the 2005 law was enacted. The law was sponsored by Assemblywoman and then Speaker Barbara Buckley, and we had...
Who's your boss, we should know. She's the executive director of Legal Aid of Southern Nevada.
Correct. We had numerous examples of overreaching and abuse by payday lenders in all kinds of, I mean, obviously they could charge whatever they wanted in terms of interest, but besides that, in the fine print of their contracts, they would have all kinds of fees that would kick in that people wouldn't expect.
Mm-hmm.
A change your phone number fee without telling them, or change your address fee. Late fees that were just outrageous and unconscionable.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to having the triple digit interest accrue continuously. So fortunately, the legislature.
So let me break in here now. Where people were coming to legal aid, and you didn't have much recourse to help them. I don't imagine without statutory protection.
That's correct.
And so somebody would come and say, how do I owe $4,000 on a $300 loan based on $25 a day late fees? And you would say, well, exactly. This is a contract.
Exactly.
And there's nothing
and
I
so,
can do.
Yeah, we were in the position, without the legislation, of just having to file an answer if they came to us in time. Usually they would come to us after a judgment had been entered against them.
Mm-hmm.
But trying to assert common law defenses like unconscionability, just arguing that this is
ridiculous, and
this is over the top.
Allow it.
It shocks.
Did that ever work?
It. Some judges were sympathetic, and some weren't.
Uh-huh.
Unconscionability boils down to whether it shocks the conscience of the court. So
yeah, it's pretty subjective.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, some people don't have a conscience, so. That would be a hard one to argue. Let me ask, is there a propensity for borrowers, payday, these high-interest loan borrowers, do they feel like this is the first person they should pay off? I mean, usually we're talking about people who are in a state of difficult economics. They're in a difficult economic situation. They probably have, they're going to pay the utility, and they've got a car payment. Now all of a sudden they've got this payday loan that they owe on. Or some high-interest loan, a title loan. Where, is the borrower more likely to pay those people first than the others, or how does it work?
I'd say I don't know, or it's hard to say how mm-hmm. people prioritize those things. I would say that I think, these folks have a job. They probably have a history of employment. They're very conscientious and feel a moral obligation to pay all their bills, and they make an honest effort to do that. Obviously, if it's rent day and you've only got X number of dollars, most people are going to prioritize for rent. And if you got a car payment, you need a car to get to work, that's up there. Of course, if you have a car title loan, you want to make sure you get that paid because you might lose your car, and that might be your means of transportation to work.
Mm-hmm.
So, having not ever been in that situation,
uh-huh.
I'm not sure how I would prioritize it myself.
Right. Yeah, that must be impossible. Unless we haven't talked about title loans, but the basic idea is what? You hand over your car title. You own your car, but you hand over the title in exchange for some lump sum, and then you pay back at some high rate of interest in order to get your title back.
That's correct.
But for many people that I imagine that, how frequently are they taking the car? I mean, how often do we see that?
I haven't seen a study done on the rate of defaults on car title loans. I think plainly that a car title lender certainly does not want to have to repossess the car and go through the hassle of selling the car to get their money back. So I think they, again, are looking at... And under the law, they're required by law to only make a car title loan amount where the borrower has the ability to repay the loan.
Mm-hmm.
There are currently, the Division of Financial Institutions is currently considering a regulation defining, quote, ability to repay, close quote, to tighten that up and put some meat on those bones.
That must be a pretty contentious issue.
It is. The industry is advocating for a regulation which is much more loose.
Mm-hmm.
To its credit, the Division of Financial Institutions has proposed a meaningful regulation.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll just have to see how that shakes out.
Mm-hmm.
But the industry says we don't want the borrower to default, and and force us to repossess and sell the car to get our principal back. Mm-hmm. So I think there again, they're looking at evaluating a borrower in terms of being able to pay that interest in 30 days. A car title loan is for 30, the original term cannot exceed 30 days, but they can roll it over six more times, so they can last over 7 months.
Mm-hmm. And there's that debt treadmill we're talking about.
Correct. So the 2005 legislation sought to stop the debt treadmill on car title loans by ending it after six rollovers. They can also have a 210-day loan, but then that has to be amortized over the period of the 210 days so that you're paying principal and interest every month so that you're not on that same kind of debt treadmill.
You're at least chipping away.
Exactly.
At the principal. You mentioned that there's this fight going on over ability to pay in car title loans. It seems to me that ever since 2005, when the original law was passed, in every session there's legislative fights over there. Sometimes they're bigger and smaller, and then it must continue in the interim. Am I correct that there's it's a pretty contentious battle that's ongoing between regulators and the industry and people like yourself who are trying to advocate for consumers?
I'd say
is it the Full Employment Act for lobbyists? That's my question.
I would say yes and no on that. At the hearing before the Division of Financial Institutions last week, I think there was a room where there were probably 50 or 75 people from industry there. Mm-hmm. And then Barbara Buckley and I were the ones there speaking for consumers. Mm-hmm. To answer your question, and as far as the yes and the no goes, in 2005, before the legislative session, we sat down with members of industry, some of the bigger players, and tried to see what type of legislation we could agree on, what would be meaningful for consumers, but yet would allow them to do business. Mm-hmm. It was perceived that there was no appetite in the Nevada legislature for enacting a usury law.
Mm-hmm. So, which would cap interest rates.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So the focus was on protections for consumers after they had entered into a loan. Mm-hmm. And the bigger players in the industry sat down with us, and we were able to mostly agree on what became Nevada Revised Statute 604A. Mm-hmm. There were others that seemed to set out to just violate the law or ignore the law. The law enacted in 2005 applied to loans of more than 40% and for less than 1 year, because everybody in the industry said, no one's going to loan for more than a year. Mm-hmm. Yet, after that law was passed, then Lucky Cash came along and just started writing their loans for 1 year and 1 day. Mm-hmm. So that they could say, none of this law applies to us.
Right. So that's when you had to come back in 2007.
And so in 2007, we had to come back and write, repeal that part that said it was for less than a year. Mm-hmm. So now it applies to everything that's over 40%. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, members of industry have been cooperative, and we've been able to work with them to pass the law. Other members of industry, as soon as you pass a law, look to evade it or just violate it.
Right, and it's a game of whack-a-mole.
Correct.
And Dan, now Congress is taking up a law that would change the regulations on this industry. It's H.R. 6139. What would that do?
The sponsors of it say that it does not apply to payday loans, and they make that argument by saying it only applies to loans of more than 30 days. Yet, it's easy to predict that if that law were passed, everyone would just write a loan of 31 days or more. Then they'd be covered by the federal law, which would preempt all the state laws, and yet the federal law has none of the protections that state law has. So it would undercut and preempt all of the protections in Nevada state payday loan laws.
Who's pushing for this legislation?
I There are two sponsors.
Well, there's Baca from California, I believe. Is,
yes, I believe that's correct.
But why? I mean, why would someone all of a sudden determine that? And let's just, I want to back up for a second. The law would create a federal charter for these institutions, right?
Correct.
And the charter would be granted by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Why do you suppose they're going in that direction?
I think the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency is not seen as a consumer protection agency. It's more of an entity that looks to how well a lender is, how healthy it is.
Mm-hmm. It's the soundness of a bank.
Correct.
Is what it's evaluating.
That's what the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency is about, is soundness and safety of a lending institution. They don't look at how those practices necessarily affect a consumer. So rather than putting, for example, the newly created Consumer Financial Protection Bureau in charge of this charter, mm-hmm. they picked the OCC.
Mm-hmm. So right off the bat, it looks a little suspicious that they're trying to evade tougher regulation of that new agency that you mentioned, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
I think that's fair to say. Mm-hmm. And they carve out an exception. If this bill were enacted, House Resolution 6139, in creating the federal charter, it also exempts persons under that charter from the Federal Truth in Lending Act, which mostly calls for disclosures like the annual percentage rate.
Mm-hmm.
That borrowers, that Congress, in enacting the Truth in Lending Act, thought was important for consumers to be able to compare and shop for credit.
Mm-hmm.
So
what could the public policy rationale be for exempting them from Truth in Lending disclosure requirements?
I don't understand a public policy rationale for exempting them from that. I would believe that the industry's argument for something like this would be that they want a federal standard. They don't want to have to comply with the different laws in the 50 states. Well, first of all, there are some 17 states and the District of Columbia that altogether outlaw payday loans or cap the interest rate at 36%.
Mm-hmm.
So a charter like this would open the door.
It would be new markets, essentially, for these companies.
It'd be new markets.
States where they would be the new frontier, states where they could not operate, and the District of Columbia, I believe, right?
That's correct.
They could also... they could open up shop there.
It would be that's right. It'd be new markets in some places. It would mean overcoming and preempting state law protections in other places, like Nevada.
So let's talk about that. Let's say the OCC, the Office of Comptroller of the Currency, creates this federal charter, and payday lenders receive a federal charter. Now they're not subject to these to 604A, the Nevada statute. All of a sudden, a bunch of our laws and regulations would go away. Which ones would be? What are we talking about?
I saw virtually no protection in the federal bill, like we have in Nevada state law. For example, in Nevada, on a deferred deposit payday loan, the original term cannot exceed 35 days, and then it cannot be extended for more than 90 days, which is aimed at the debt treadmill. That would all be out the window. Nevada law limits the loan amount to 25% of the borrower's expected gross monthly income. So there would be no limit on the amount of the loan if this federal charter went through. And then Nevada law provides that if you default on your payday loan, then the interest rate drops immediately to the prime rate plus 10%. In other words, interest does not continue to accrue at 3, 4, 5, 600% APR, whatever mm-hmm. the loan terms are. It drops to prime plus 10, which again is aimed at stopping the debt treadmill,
mm-hmm.
putting someone in a position where they have a chance of repaying what they owe. I saw none of those protections in this federal bill.
Mm-hmm. Now also, 604A, our statute, prevents these companies from going after the borrower in criminal courts.
That's true.
That's before, probably just up that we don't know what would happen there.
Before 2005, right, some payday lenders would take your check, which if it bounced, then they would contend that the criminal law, which provides the treble damages or three times the amount of damages for a bad check, that they'd be entitled to that. Mm-hmm. And the payday loan law says they can't do that.
Mm-hmm. And then I imagine, so that also would entail court fees and all kinds of other fees that they could tack on as well in that process.
Sure. That's one thing that the payday loan law also provides that once you default, the lender has to offer you an opportunity to enter into a repayment plan before they sue you. And so you have the opportunity to pay off what you owe without getting sued. Because once you're sued, then you're right. There's court costs, attorney's fees. After a judgment is entered, then there's post-judgment interest. Then it gets turned over to the constable. The constable charges a commission as well as fees when they go out to garnish your employer or attach your bank account.
Mm-hmm. And then, obviously the numbers for say, minorities, blacks, Hispanics, and then also foreign-born non-citizens, there's much higher in terms of the percent that are unbanked and underbanked. I think it's 55% total for blacks, 51% for foreign-born non-citizens, and a total of 48% for Hispanics. And, I mean, are they targeting these groups, or is it because of their lack of access, maybe, or their non-citizenship status, they're not using the banks, but are, or also that they're targeting those specific communities as well for these loans?
I'm sure the industry denies that they would target any minorities. But I think I know
we don't call it targeting; we call it marketing.
Marketing, yeah. Are they marketing to these communities?
I think statistics show that minorities receive and take out a disproportionate share of these kinds of high interest loans. Yes, I know that in 2005, when we were preparing to submit the payday loan law, we did Fair Housing, Fair Lending Center here in town did a study and showed where that there was a disproportionate number of payday lenders in minority areas.
And I imagine that trend is probably continued. Although on the other hand, I think, and you mentioned this the other day when I was talking to you, payday lenders no longer just in working class neighborhoods.
That's right. They're they're all over town and. They're in strip malls everywhere.
Mm-hmm. Well, on that uplifting note, we're going to close this out. We want to thank Dan Wolls. He's the Deputy Executive Director of Legal Aid of Southern Nevada. We've been talking about high-interest alternative financial products. My co-host is Tovin LePan, and our producer is Stephen Zeller. Catch us next Wednesday for Neon Eden. Thanks for tuning in.